Chapter 14, The Yoga of the Division of the Three Gunas. The Holy Lord said, I shall tell you supreme knowledge, which is the best of all knowledge, having known which all the sages attained to highest perfection. Resorting to this knowledge, they attain identity with me. At creation they are not born, nor tremble at its dissolving. For me, great Brahma is the womb, and in that do I place the egg, the origin of all beings, then comes from that Oparita. Whatever be the forms produced within all wombs, son of Kunti, of them Brahma is the great womb, and I the seed-casting father. Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas, these gunas born of Prakriti, bind fast in the body him who is indestructible embodied. Sattva is stainless, luminous, and free from defect, yet it binds by attachment to happiness and by attachment to knowledge. No Rajas's nature is passion, producing thirst and attachment. It binds fast the embodied one by the attachment to action. Tamas is born of ignorance, stupefying the embodied. It binds by miscomprehension, indolence, and sleep bhadata. Sattva attaches to happiness, Rajas to action, Parata, and Tamas, obscuring knowledge, attaches unto delusion. Sattva prevails over Rajas and Tamas, and Rajas prevails over Sattva and Tamas over Sattva Rajas. When through each sense of the body, the light of knowledge clearly shines, then it should be known that Sattva is there fully predominant. Activity, undertaking of actions, greed, unrest, longing. When Rajas is predominant, all these arise, O Bharata. Darkness, inertness, heedlessness, and delusion, all these arise when Tamas is predominant, O descendant of the Kurus. If the embodied one meets death when Sattva is predominant, then he attains the stainless realms of the knowers of the highest. Meeting death in Rajas, he's born amid those attached to action. Dying in Tamas, he is born from the wombs of the deluded. The fruit of good action, they say, is sattvic and pure, verily. The fruit of Rajas is pain and ignorance, the fruit of Tamas. From Sattva arises wisdom, from Rajas greed, while from Tamas arises miscomprehension and delusion and ignorance. The Sattva biting go upwards, Rajasics dwell in the middle, Tamasics abiding in the lowest guna do go downward. When the seer beholds no agent other than the gunas and knows that which is higher than gunas, he attains unto my being. He who goes beyond these gunas, which are the source of the body, is freed from birth, death, disease, pain, and attains immortality. Arjuna said, by what marks, O Lord, is he known who has gone beyond the gunas? What is his conduct, and how does he pass beyond these three gunas? The Holy Lord said, he who hates not the appearance of light and of activity and delusion, O Pandava, nor yet longs for them when absent. He sitting like one unconcerned, who is not moved by the gunas, knowing the gunas operate, stands firm and is unwavering. The same in pleasure and in pain, he sees earth, stone, and gold alike, alike to pleasing, displeasing, firm, the same in censure and praise, the same in honor and disgrace, the same to friend and enemy, renouncing all undertakings, he has gone beyond the gunas. He who renders service to me with unswerving devotion, he, going beyond the three gunas, is fit for union with Brahman. I am the abode of Brahman, the immortal, immutable, abode of eternal Dharma, abode of the absolute bliss. Om Tat Sat. Thus in the Upanishads of the glorious Bhagavad Gita, the science of the eternal, the scripture of yoga, the dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna, ends the 14th discourse entitled The Yoga of the Division of the Three Gunas. Chapter 17, The Yoga of the Division of Threefold Faith. Arjuna said, those who set aside prescriptions of scriptures doing sacrifice with faith, what is their condition, sattva or rajas or tamas? The Holy Lord said, threefold is the embodied faith inherent within their nature, the sattvic, rajasic, and the tamasic. Do you hear of it? Each one's faith is according to his natural disposition. Yeah, the man consists of his faith. In truth, he is what his faith is. The sattvic men worship the gods, rajasic, yakshas, rakshasas. The others, the tamasic men, the pretas and hosts of putas. Those of extreme austerities, unscriptural, given to show, and egoity impelled by the force of lust and attachment, to torture, senseless as they are, all the organs in the body, and me, the body's indweller, know them as of demonic will. The food also liked by each one is threefold, as is sacrifice, austerity, and almsgiving. Hear from me now their distinction. Food building, life, purity, strength, health, joy, cheerfulness, appetite, savory, agreeable, and substantial, such the sattvic like. Foods that are bitter, sour, salty, excessively hot, pungent, dry, and burning the rajasic like, producing pain, grief, and disease. That which is stale, tasteless, stinking, cooked overnight, refuse, impure, is the food the tamasic like. This is the truth, O Arjuna. That sacrifice which is offered without desire for reward and according to scripture's command, intent as duty, is sattvic. That which is performed, Arjuna, seeking for fruit and for vain show, know that to be a sacrifice, rajasic in his character. Sacrifice unscriptural and without the offering of food, without mantras or gifts or faith, is tamasic in character. Worship of gods, twice born teachers, the wise, purity, continence, straightforwardness, non-injury, are austerity of body. Unvexing speech, agreeable, true beneficial practice of self-study, these are said to form what is austerity of speech. Steady serenity of mind, kindliness, silence, self-control, honesty of motive, all this is called mental austerity. This threefold austerity done with highest faith by those without desire for fruit, also steadfast, is considered to be sattvic. austerity practice to gain welcome, honor, worship, and with ostentation is rajasic, unstable and transitory. Austerity with self-torture, done out of a foolish notion, or for the purpose of harming another, is called tamasic. That gift which is given to one who does no service in return, in a fit place to one worthy, that gift is held to be sattvic. And what is given with a view to receiving in return, or looking for the fruit or again, reluctantly is rajasic. That gift given at the wrong place or time to unworthy persons, without respect or with disdain, that is declared as tamasic. Om Tat Sat, this has been declared the triple title of Brahman. By that were created of old Brahmins, Vedas, and sacrifice. Sacrifice, gifts, austerities, according to the scriptures are begun with utterance of Om by the expounders of Brahman. Uttering Tat without desire for fruits, thus our sacrifice, gift, and austerity then performed by seekers of liberation. Tat is used with the meaning of reality and of goodness. So also the word Sat is used in the sense of auspicious acts. Steadfastness in sacrifice, gift, and austerity is called Sat. Also action in connection with these is designated Sat. Whatever is sacrificed, given, or done, whatever austerity is practiced without faith is known here or hereafter as a Sat. Om Tat Sat. Thus in the Upanishads of the glorious Bhagavad Gita, the science of the eternal, the scripture of yoga, the dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna, ends the 17th discourse entitled The Yoga of the Division of Threefold Faith.
Om Tat Sat. If you are listening to the beautiful rendition of the Gita, you heard the last instruction that Krishna gives to Arjuna and to us at the end of chapter 17. He's just explained to Arjuna how the three gunas operate in our spiritual practices and by extension in the rest of our life. And having given a pretty hardcore dismissal of any form of practice that is not sattvic, he then gives Arjuna what I consider the easy pass to, for those of you who live in California where freeways can be entered by an easy pass. And he says, if you start every action with the words Om Tat Sat and end every action with Om Tat Sat, you infuse them with auspiciousness. So I'll say a little bit more about Om Tat Sat as a mantra when we get to it in the course of today. But let's just feel it. And I'm just going to chant Om Tat Sat a couple of times, and then I want to do some housekeeping, and then we'll go into our beginning chant and meditation. Om represents the outward flowing energy of consciousness, of the divine, of goddess in her manifesting form. So the syllable Om, which of course as we know is the foundational seed mantra that flows through really every tradition in India, comes from the Vedas, is considered to be the essence of all scriptures and also to be the form of the absolute in its personal form, in the form of Krishna, Vishnu, Shiva, the Ishwara aspect of the divine is signified by Om. Tat means God. Tat is, again, as you know, it's the Vedic and Upanishadic way of pointing to the absolute, which is beyond all description, which is formless, attributeless, unknowable in by the mind or senses. And sat in this context means truth or reality. It also means auspiciousness. So when we say Om Tat Sat, we say action is flowing forth, fully inspired, on the radiance of the endless, eternal Om. That action is filled with God, with Tatness, with the Absolute itself, because this action recognizes that everything is that oneness. And it's an auspicious action. It's a true, authentic, real action. And when we begin an action by intoning Om Tat Sat, Om Tat Sat, Om Tat Sat, we actually identify our action as being the divine action. It's a very powerful practice and process. And in my experience, it doesn't have to be the mantra Om Tat Sat. It can be Om Namah Shivaya or Om Namo Narayanaya or Om Aim Hrim Shrim Chamundaye Vichay Swaha or any one of the mantras that calls forth the experience of the divine. But starting and finishing our actions with mantra is a practice that has really, really changed my life, and I know that's true of many of you as well. So this is our next-to-last class, and somehow I had the idea that if we did a second series in the Bhagavad Gita, we would manage to completely finish it, that we'd be able to go through all the chapters. But as we have come to realize, this text is so rich, it's so profound, that we just didn't have time in our 6 weeks to finish it. So we're going to do triage, or that is to say, I have done triage and made an executive decision that in this class we're going to discuss chapters 14 and 17 and really get into Krishna's teaching on the gunas, the three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas, because it is such a big deal in the Bhagavad Gita. And then next week we'll work with chapter 18, which is a culmination, and which to me is really, in a certain way, again, this is my own prejudice here, but I feel that we read and study the Gita so that we can really savor chapter 18, because it contains everything that's in the other books, but in a particularly sublime and intimate way. So, and in order to enter that, we do need to understand, to pass through Krishna's instructions for how we navigate the world of change. And these two chapters, 14 and 17, are two of the crucial clues for that. So I also wanted to tell you that we are going to be having a special live group discussion meeting on July 19th, which is the Wednesday following our final class in this series. And we're doing this because I've really been missing the opportunity for all of you to get together and discuss these verses. So we're going to do it on Maestro Conference, which allows us to break into small groups, triads, and you guys will get some verses and questions to start you off, and we'll move back and forth between the small groups and large group sharing, and everyone will hopefully have a chance to interact about some of the wisdom and some of the insight and some of the experience that has been coming forth as you and the Bhagavad Gita interact. I also want to say something about one of the chapters that we're skipping, chapter 15, the Yoga of the Supreme Person. And I'm sort of apologizing to Krishna for not working with this chapter. It's part of what you do in triage, but I really want to suggest that you read it yourself and that you read it in one of the ways that it's traditionally read in Vaishnava circles in India. And I'll say more about that in a minute. Chapter 15, the Yoga of the Supreme Person, is a hugely important practice. It's literally used as a practice. It's the chapter that is often read or sung aloud to a person who's dying, and also before the corpse, before the body of the person after death. My brother and I sang this for our father when he had left his body. And the reason for it, the reason we do that, is to remind the soul who may be leaving the body or hovering around the body in the first hours or even days after the passing, to remind the soul of who he is, of where she comes from. And for that reason, the text says in very, very beautiful language, describes this universe as an upside-down Ashwata tree. An Ashwata tree is a kind of fig. It's actually a very fashionable houseplant these days, this particular type of fig tree. But in the image that Krishna uses, it's a tree whose roots are in heaven and its branches in the world, in the physical world. And of course, one of the points of this image is to give us is to show us that everything that exists in this world has its roots in the absolute. It's not actually heaven where the tree is rooted. It's in the eternal Purushottama. According to Abhinavagupta, the real meaning of this image, which of course does refer to an actual fig tree that you can see if you happen to live in India, the peepal or fig tree is very common. But it's the real meaning of the name of the tree has to do with the Sanskrit etymology, which contains the image, contains the idea that the tree doesn't really exist, that it's illusory, that it actually comes into being out of the absolute as a vast and beautiful thought in the mind of God, which disappears as soon as we realize what it is and who we are. But in the meantime, it's a kind of an endless branching, very, very beautiful play of branches and roots and leaves that includes everything, the beautiful scriptures of the traditions, as well as the evil deeds of demonic people and villains, and our aspirations as well as our failures. It's the tree that shows how the world arises inside the one, descend into manifestation, but never lose its connection with the source. So reading chapter 15 is a way of putting yourself into the recognition of who you are and where you come from. As Krishna says, fragment of my eternal self takes on the form of an individual soul in the world of living beings, drawing to itself the senses with the mind. And that connection is never lost, no matter what. So one of the ways we traditionally read chapter 15 is during meals. So as you're eating, taking in physical nourishment, you also take in the highest form of nourishment, and I'm going to suggest that you consider doing this a couple of times this week, either reading from the book, the chapter, or actually listening to the recording that we play at the beginning of class, listening to the verses of chapter 15. So let's find a posture, an upright, relaxed, very conscious, mindful posture. Taking a moment just to reel back in your mind from all the places that it might have gone in the course of the day, as minds tend to do. Breathing in, feeling the connection of the sit bones with the seat. Exhaling and feeling the way the breath moves through the body, moves upward through the body and actually releases into the region above the crown. And then with the next inhalation, see if you can connect to the lower dantian, to the energy in the belly center. And if it's not easy for you to immediately breathe into the lower dantian, remember that you can just take a few minutes to let your attention flow around the belly, starting about three finger widths below the navel. And just find the place where you click in, where the key clicks in the lock, and where you feel this grounded, centered, and very powerful presence that is your hara, your your belly energy, your true gut wisdom. And with awareness flowing down through the crown into the dantian, up through the heart, rising through the crown, with that awareness, we'll chant three times our introductory mantras, and then we'll meditate. I salute Madhava, Krishna, the source of supreme bliss, whose grace makes a dumb person eloquent and lets a cripple cross mountains. This translation actually calls Krishna the source of supreme bliss. In fact, the Sanskrit doesn't have the word source. It basically says, I salute Krishna, who is supreme bliss. So these verses are actually a salutation to bliss itself. Mukham karoti vachalam pangam langayate giram yat kripa tamaham vande paramananda madhavam. Mukham karoti vachalam pangam langayate giram yat kripa tamaham vande paramananda madhavam. Mukham karoti vachalam pangam langayate giram yat kripa tamaham vande paramananda madhavam. So as you bring your awareness back to the breath, have the feeling that Krishna stretches forth above your crown as a vast cloud of undulating blue radiance. And if you have an easeful relationship with personal visualizations, you can certainly visualize Krishna sitting above your head. But the main thing is to have a sense that this grace-filled presence, which is supremely blissful, which is this very source of wisdom, which is gathered here, holding the Sangam together, and also flowing his truth, his light, his radiance, his blissfulness, his oneness through our bodies at this moment. And as we do this meditation, as we begin this meditation, let's bring our hands together in Anjali Mudra, bow our heads just at the beginning. We'll go back to an ordinary meditation posture in a moment. And just have the sense of asking Krishna, asking this vast radiance of supreme consciousness, the Purushottama, the supreme being, to allow the words of this teaching to penetrate our hearts and bodies and minds more and more deeply as we hear and practice together. So as the breath flows in through the crown, it flows in with the sense that Krishna's innate radiance is flowing through the head, neck, flowing down through the body, all the way down through the upper and lower torso, through the arms, down through the hips and thighs and knees and calves and feet. And then with the exhalation, we allow the feeling of opening to arise so that our exhalation opens us to receiving Krishna's light. The inhalation draws that light into the body. And if it feels natural and right, you can allow the mantra Om Namo Narayanaya to flow in with the breath as well, carrying with it the particles of Krishna's sound form. Inhaling, drawing in the radiant blue light of Krishna's consciousness all the way through the body. Exhaling and feeling the body, mind, and heart opening to receive that light. This week we're going to enter the three gunas again. We looked at the gunas a little bit in our last class, and this paradigm, of course, is one that so many of you have spent time considering, so it's not unfamiliar to most of you. And many of you have done some self-inquiry regarding how the gunas play in you. So I just want to ask you for forgiveness if you feel that anything I'm saying is repetitive, and also to point out that one of Krishna's big tactics in the Gita is to repeat the same teaching over and over and over again, because he knows that material, the wisdom, the teaching, the paradigms of material life are being drummed into us pretty much 24/7. And in the same way, we need to keep repeating the teachings of the truth so that they become as deeply rooted in us as our ignorance, and ultimately more so. So one of the most really influential and important of Krishna's teachings in the Gita, and certainly among his most practical, is the way he speaks about the gunas in chapters 14 and 17. We said a few weeks ago that the last chapters of the Bhagavad Gita actually unpack key ideas that appear in the first six chapters, but in the last six, they're given in more detail, they're looked at from different angles, and they're also made very practical. This material on the gunas, the material that we find in the Bhagavad Gita on the gunas, is probably the most authoritative discourse in spiritual literature, at least in the in literature of the quality of the Gita, which is considered an utterly foundational text. This is where you go to find out about the gunas, and there are also some very, very interesting commentaries about the gunas, which is helpful to read when you're looking to understand yourself. Part of what Krishna is always doing with Arjuna, from what we could call a tantric point of view, and I fully believe that Krishna is the original tantrika, he's always trying to help Arjuna navigate this world. And the world that he wants Arjuna to learn to navigate is actually the world of the gunas, because there is nothing that we can experience in normal life that is not the gunas. So he begins this chapter 14, we're in chapter 14 now, by telling Arjuna, as he does periodically throughout the text, that what he's giving Arjuna here is the supreme knowledge, and that it's a way of becoming one with Krishna. He says, I will again declare the supreme knowledge, the highest of all knowings, which having known, all the sages have gone to the highest perfection. Having taken refuge in this knowledge and become of like nature and dharma of being with me, the word is saddharmya, meaning the dharma of oneness with truth. Having taken refuge in this knowledge and become of like nature of saddharmya with me, they are not born in the creation nor troubled by the anguish of the universal dissolution. And he then goes on to remind Arjuna of his metaphysical teaching, his basic metaphysical teaching of how the universe comes into being. And the image he uses is of the divine masculine impregnating the divine feminine. He says he implants the seed of creation in the womb of what he calls Mahat Brahman, which literally means great, vast, absolute. Great Brahma, and when he says Brahma here, he means Brahma as the creative aspect of the divine, meaning, in other words, Shakti herself. He says, this is my womb. In it I place the seed. The origin of all beings exists in this, O Arjuna. And Abhinavagupta's commentary, which is the Tantric Kashmiri Shaiva reading of this verse, and which is actually in the Kashmiri version of the Bhagavad Gita, which Abhinava is speaking from, the word Mahat Brahman is actually code for Swatantriya Shakti, goddess himself, goddess herself, whom Krishna calls mine. She's his Swatantriya Shakti, his power of freedom. Swatantriya means absolute freedom. In other words, she's inseparable from him. So in a certain sense, he's impregnating himself, if you don't mind the image. And this is, of course, fundamental metaphor that throughout the Indian scriptures for the way things come into being, Krishna impregnates his yoni, that's the word he uses, yoni meaning both vagina and womb, his own yoni, actually. And in Nyaneshwari, Nyaneshwara has Krishna describing this womb of reality as Maya, which, as we know, can Maya can be seen as another name for the great Shakti, inner creative aspect. And Maya can also be seen as the fundamental ignorance, the veiling power, which disguises the self so that we who are limitless believe ourselves limited, and then becomes a kind of dynamic, subtle substance, a suchness, a consciousness inherently creative, yet unaware of itself. So we're talking here about Sankhya metaphysics, and we're talking here about Prakriti, whom we looked at in some detail last week. And as you remember, Prakriti is described in the dualistic philosophy of Sankhya as being inherently creative but unconscious, so that she needs the consciousness of Purusha, the eternal witness, to activate her, while Purusha needs the creativity of Prakriti in order to manifest anything. And Krishna says, Maya is my wife, eternal yet ever youthful and of indescribable qualities. And, of course, their child is the universe, which we always have to remember, even as we talk in this, you know, kind of dualistic way that we will be talking in, is completely permeated with Krishna himself. So there's actually a profound paradox here. This world is created out of ignorance of the self, and yet it is completely permeated with the light of the self. As Krishna says, whatever forms are produced in any womb, Arjuna, the great absolute is their womb, and I am the seed-sowing father. So, and again, we're playing with the image of the field and the knower of the field. Karen Shatar wrote a few days ago about how she's having this experience of seeing the physical world as permeated with shimmering light. And this particular shift of vision, which I've experienced and which others of you have experienced, is actually the beginning of a genuine experiential visionary awakening. That is, it's the awakening of your capacity to see the light underneath everything. It's, for many of us, it happens perhaps in meditation, perhaps for a few minutes here and there, gradually becomes more and more of a normal experience. And eventually my guru used to say that in his fully awakened state, in his enlightened state, wherever he looked, he would see this blue light, which he called the blue light of consciousness, pervading everything. And then he would see the forms, that is, you and me and the lamppost and the desk, appearing in the blue light. And he used to sing a song from one of the poet saints of India, which says, my eyes have been washed with the ointment of knowledge, so I see the world as it is, as permeated with the light of God. So the field, Prakriti, is actually made of light, of shimmering energy, but inside this light is a many-colored, undulating dance of sattva, rajas, and tamas, the three gunas, or qualities of nature. And this is where he begins his discourse. Now, guna, the word guna, is untranslatable. So we usually translate it as qualities, but quality doesn't really express how incredibly powerful, creative, and foundational the gunas are to all experience. So if you look at the Gita from Krishna's perspective, that is, from the depths of what he's saying to us, you realize that by telling Arjuna how the gunas work, he's actually giving Arjuna a kind of a map which should allow him to play the game of life better. In other words, to make his choices with full recognition of what this world really is and of what it is that's controlling his mind and his heart and his actions. What he wants Arjuna to understand is that this world is simultaneously a non-dual face of the One, but it's also the play of the gunas. And the gunas being the substance of Prakriti, the gunas are, it's said that Prakriti is the gunas, and therefore there's this, Prakriti has this quality of constant change, of constant transformation. I once had a meditation vision of this, and I didn't really understand it at the time. In fact, I didn't really understand what it was until I started reading this chapter a few days ago. I went, oh my God, I had a vision of the three gunas in Prakriti. So here was the vision. I saw this vast rope of light, which had a kind of kaleidoscopic quality. It was consisted of different strands of colored light, which were undulating and dancing with each other, and which were basically red, blue, and white. It was very, very beautiful and completely ecstatic, and I understood at the time what I was seeing was Shakti, that I was watching the dance of reality. And I remember at the time, I think that I was, you know, after 20 or 30 minutes of this really exquisite, ecstatic, visionary experience, I started doing what I often do in moments of heightened awareness, which is say, okay, enough of that. I'm ready to kind of take rest in my fundamental ignorance for a few minutes. Just, you know, take a vacation from the beauty of reality, which Krishna would say is exactly how we get ourselves into trouble. But then I realized something. I realized that I couldn't make this vision go away, and that in fact, I couldn't make this dance go away. I saw, what I guess was one of the lessons, so to speak, of the vision, I saw that this undulating, three-stranded, kaleidoscopic dance was eternal. And I started to get a sense of what eternal means. And I got awed and then scared. I would say that awe is a sattvic emotion. Fear, of course, is a rajasic emotion. So I was having an experience of how sattva changes into tama, into rajas. I did something that I guess I can thank my spiritual practice for having shown me how to do. That is, I became the witness. I literally took refuge in being the witness of this dance. And then for some time, I sat as a witness and watched the dance happening. So this image of reality as a dance of a three-stranded rope, colored rope, ecstatically manifesting in different forms, is an image, of course, of how the play of the gunas works. There are many different ways we can see this process. You know, meditative visions are often symbolic representations of truths that appear to us as visions because it's easier for us to grasp something so profound if we can see something. What I also realized as I contemplated this experience in the last day is that the me that was witnessing was my soul, was my Purusha. And in this experience, in this meditation, the Purusha, the witness self, was experienced as separate from Prakriti, from the dance of reality, no longer enmeshed in it. My sense at the time was that there was another step, which, you know, if one can take Krishna's teaching to Arjuna as the form, the step would be to allow Prakriti to merge into Purusha so that you become aware that this wild, eternal, ecstatic dance is actually going on inside your own consciousness, which is the Supreme Consciousness. I didn't get there, but I've never forgotten it. And I do believe that the awe and helplessness that we can experience when we recognize the endlessness of this dance really is an inspiration to investigate life more deeply. In other words, to learn how to become free within the play of the gunas in a way that is actually tantric. And here again, this is an interpretation of the Gita. It's the non-dual tantric interpretation. There are other ways of looking at it. But my deep conviction, my faith, as we'll see when we get into the faith part of this class, is that liberation is to first extract yourself from being embedded, from being at the affect of the play, and then to recognize that the play is happening inside you. There's a beautiful verse among the many gorgeous verses in this chapter in Yaneshwari. Krishna says, when a person's vision is illuminated by the experience of oneness, we call this devotion. So Krishna is actually teaching Arjuna how to both stand aside from the play and also learn how to recognize the play as his own supreme consciousness. The gunas, twisted together like the strand of a rope, are often said to have three colors: sky blue or white for sattva, red for rajas, and black or dark blue for tamas. Sattva then is a sky-like openness. It's the spaciousness of pure illumined awareness, although not the ultimate pure illumined awareness. We'll get to that. Rajas is associated with blood and sap, with the life force that carries the nutrients that sustain life, and which is also associated with passion. So Rajas is the power to make things happen, the power of life, the life force itself. Tamas is the dark richness of earth, of the soil, from which all life forms on this earth emerge and into which all life forms dissolve. And sattva, rajas, and tamas get their strength from their twining. You know, it's, in other words, one of the reasons they're unbreakable is because they're inseparable. And the physical world gets its power to exist from the twining of the gunas. In Sankhya, in Vedanta, and in Shaivism, the world that we know, including our own psyche and, of course, our body, arises from different combinations of gunas. And it's actually very interesting, if you ever get to study the tattvas, the stages of manifestation, to look at what the texts of Sankhya and Vedanta say about the ways in which sattva, rajas, and tamas combine in us. Getting that actually helped me really grok how that supremely subtle absolute consciousness could possibly become this embodied person that I call Sally. From Krishna's point of view, it's the psychological aspects of the gunas that are most important, at least in this conversation with Arjuna. And another point that comes from the tantras, from Abhinavagupta's commentary, is that the gunas, purity, activity, and dullness, are actually, or we could say, spaciousness, movement, and inertness, sleep, the three gunas are actually limited expressions of the three great shaktis, the innate powers of the Supreme Reality. So the absolute, the transcendent suchness, Krishna, Lakshmi, Shiva, Shakti, if we want to give that personal names, has these three intrinsic powers: the power to will, to desire, the power to know, and the power to act, Icha Shakti, Jnana Shakti, and Kriya Shakti. And the point of this non-dual teaching is that these three powers, which are God's own powers, operate throughout creation, as the Shaiva scriptures say, from Shiva to the earth. The three great Shaktis are always in operation. But when consciousness contracts, when the veiling Shakti of Maya brings limitation, these three powers become the three gunas In order to act as a physical and psychological universe, so the power of will or desire becomes Rajaguna, the power of knowledge becomes Sattvaguna, and the power of action becomes Tamaguna. And that may seem slightly confusing, but finding these correspondences is sometimes requires going a little bit deeper. I want to say also that the Godhead beings, the Ishwara, the faces of Ishwara, of personal divinity, also correspond to the gunas. So traditionally, Vishnu, Lakshmi are said to be sattva-guna in nature. Brahma, Saraswati, who are creative, are said to be have the quality of rajas-guna. And Shiva-Kali, or Rudra-Kali, are said to have to be of the tamas guna persuasion. So you see from this description that the gunas can be seen in a very exalted way. Krishna in the Gita focuses on the psychological aspects of the gunas for two reasons. The first is that he wants Arjuna to know that as long as he identifies with the body-mind rather than the self, his inner life will never be under his control. The second reason, as I think, is that he wants Arjuna to be able to see how the gunas play so that he can just do his life better. And the core of this is the recognition that what we experience as happiness, passion, and dullness are not really his personal feelings, even though they, of course, take the form of a very personal feelings. They're the activity of the gunas. And as long as we identify with each state of mind, we are going to experience its effects, and we're going to be tossed around because these three qualities are inherent in our mental and emotional tendencies, and each one of them binds us. And it's very interesting to think about how the gunas manifest on the physical level in our psychological experience, because I believe that our brain chemistry, our endocrine system, actually, you know, again, we're in a non-dual universe. So if the gunas operate on a subtle level as mind states or emotional states, they also are very profoundly influenced physically by our brain chemistry. Maybe serotonin is a predominantly sattvic hormone. Dopamine, perhaps predominantly rajasic. Perhaps cortisol imbalances or adrenaline depletion can be associated with tamas, or maybe cortisol is rajasic. But it's very interesting to recognize that the gunas can be experienced at every single level of embodied consciousness, physically, psychologically, and also inside our spiritual practice. And since each guna has the power to completely take over our personal consciousness, that means that until the witness is fully operative in our being, until we really are identified with the consciousness that is present to all this and contains it, we're going to identify totally with how we feel when a particular guna is dominant. And that's really, I think, the purpose of this teaching in chapter 14 and 17. Because remember, Krishna has an agenda. He wants Arjuna to realize that turning away from the battle is not a sattvic inclination, even though it looks like it, even though it may seem that his desire to not fight the battle comes from compassion. What Krishna wants him to get is that it is actually tamasic confusion and ignorance that makes him want to stand aside from the battle. So that's why the only real choice for Arjuna's freedom and our freedom is not to try to figure out what to do, but to begin by aligning ourselves with the divine nature, with the saddharmya, the natural activity of the divine, which is always knowable when our intention is to give ourselves in devotion to the wisdom of the Absolute, to the wisdom of Krishna. And it's interesting also to consider that the Gita's three most effective practices for dealing with the endless dance of the gunas are A, to become the witness, to deepen your identification with your own awareness, B, to offer everything, and three, to constantly and skillfully draw the sense of divine presence into your body in a devotional way. Yoneshwar says about this that when one offers one's desires to the fire of wisdom, the result is that one becomes the fire. And this is actually the purpose of all these practices. By really being the witness, you become that. You recognize that you are that. When you offer everything to the divine, eventually you become the divine through the offering. And when you do this devotional meditation of bringing the divine consciousness or the divine form into your body, you also become that. Essentially what Krishna is saying ultimately is that even the practices of being a good person, which he totally endorses, do not in themselves free you. But, of course, he also wants us to know, and he really presses this point, that purpose of our sadhana, of our practice, is actually to let us become established in sattva, to show us how to make the sattvic choices. And again, it's paradoxical because on one level he says we don't have choice. On another level he says that we actually do have choice. And that's a paradox that I think we all need to figure out for ourselves. What does it mean, really, to choose the sattvic path? It's very much something that we practice, that we can practice. And the real strength of this kind of practice comes when we are actually feeling overwhelmed by passion and desire, or by anger and jealousy, which are rajasic feelings, or when we are just sunk in dullness and despair and sleepiness and just don't care about doing any practices in a tamasic state. We learn how to choose sattva even when we're really stuck in one of the other gunas. And we do it by working with one of these practices, one of these three practices in some form or another. So being able to tell the difference between one guna and another is important. And it's also important, ultimately, to be able to tell the difference between sattva guna and the experience of true enlightenment. Because sattva guna, when we're really in sattva guna, it really looks like enlightenment. In chapter 14 in verse 11, Krishna says, when all the doors of the body are flooded with light, a light of understanding, perception, and knowledge, you should understand that there has been a great upsurge of sattva guna. So, you know, it's kind of an enjoyable game. One I like, because I do like paradigms, to just go through your life, noticing what's sattvic, what feels rajasic, what feels tamasic in the physical world. So, you know, clear pool of water, sattvic. Ocean waves, rajasic. Stagnant dirty water in your dishpan, tamasic. Moonlight, sattvic. Hot sunlight, rajasic. Overcast skies, you know, low barometric pressure, tamasic. Bach's cantatas, basically sattvic. Beethoven's symphonies, essentially rajasic. Contemporary pop music, often tamasic, although there's actually an experimental rock band that calls itself Tamasic. That's the name of the band. Plays a lot of repetitive downbeat. And, of course, a true artist plays with all the gunas, literally uses the gunas as the palette of their art. And perhaps one of the reasons that we're drawn to certain types of art in particular moods has to do to some extent with the guna that is predominant in that state. And that's something that I want to encourage you to practice. Like, what makes you, you know, want to go see Baby Driver, current very intense chase movie that came out a few weeks ago, which is super rajasic? What would make you want to see Pulp Fiction, a movie that I think is great? You know, Pulp Fiction is a very, very tamasic, a genius piece of tamasic art. So learning to understand how the things you take in affect your state and how to categorize them without necessarily being averse to those expressions but actually being able to pick and choose the tastes while always remembering that your intention is to stay pretty much in sattva. Krishna also says, and again, this is a hugely significant point, all the gunas bind us when we identify with them. As you know, when you feel happy, light, pure, exalted, spiritual, smart, what you automatically do is identify with that state and say, I'm happy and I must have been doing something right. And, oh my God, I'm feeling really insightful. Insights are just coming down the pipe. Maybe I've gained some psychic siddhis. I understand this so well. Or no, we take a bath and we smell the fragrance of soap on our skin and we feel I'm pure. And we want to sustain that state, to bring ourselves more deeply into that state. And when we do that, when we identify with sattva and want to reject those parts of ourselves and others that don't feel so sattvic, what we've done is acquired a sattvic ego. And Krishna says that sattva guna binds us through attachment to being happy, to being a good person, to being illumined, to being intelligent, to being subtle, to being in harmonious situations. You know, sattva guna tends to be quite conflict averse and will go to great lengths to maintain a sattvic atmosphere in a conversation, even when it means not confronting somebody. This is one of the characteristics of a sattvic ego. And, you know, having lived in ashrams and spiritual circles for about 45 years, I consider myself an expert on the spiritual ego. I have one myself. You know, it's involved in your knowledge of Sanskrit and your awake, you know, your pride and your subtle pride and your relative awakeness, you know, of your detachment and your kindness. And a tendency, you might have noticed this in yourself when you're in a sattvic state, to kind of avoid your friends who are kind of more confused and depressed. And one of the things that I've been noticing in my, you know, putting on my hat, at my sociological hat, I've noticed that a lot of the young millennials I know, I'm talking about the kids of some of my friends who are in their late teens and early 20s and who are really deep purists about their politics, about their lifestyle, you know, a lot of them have what I would call the sattvic ego of being woke, you know, of their egalitarian attitudes about gender, their vegan diets, their sustainably sourced clothing. It's all part of the sattvic ego. And we do get very down on ourselves when these great, wise, happy states disappear. And because the gunas are constantly chasing each other, the sattvic states just don't last. That pure light meditation experience, that perfect insight, that blissful merging into your lover's eyes is going to change. Your meditation will become restless, or your next one, you know, you'll just feel turgid. The insight will turn out to be not possible for you to apply when you're in the middle of a crisis. You and your lover will start noticing each other's bad moods, or one of you will lose interest, and the powers of rajas and tamas will overwhelm sattva. Raja guna binds us through our desires, our seeking. Rajas is really the seeking self. It's, you know, we want to accomplish, to acquire, to be loved, to be celebrated, to be recognized, to be loved. We constantly seek this. And in its extreme form, and Krishna's going to have some really scathing things to say about Raja guna, which is basically the drive behind the greed and ambition of Arjuna's evil cousins. He's going to say a lot of scathing things about it, but Rajaguna, in its neutral form, is simply activity. It's the kinetic force of nature, so we need it. And it's the source of our desires, including the very painful ones, but it's also the quality that lets us stand up to injustice and act creatively. But of course, since none of our longings can ever be fulfilled in the material world, the natural state of Rajaguna involves restlessness, anxiety, unease, wanting, grief, anger, greed, fear of loss, jealousy. And since we live in a rajasic society fueled by caffeine being a kind of liquid Rajaguna, we live you know, we live in a world that's dominated by Rajoguna, and with some significant pockets of misery and darkness filled with Tamoguna, apathy, numbness, and grief. But Krishna's point always is that doing your best to function from an intention towards sattva, to make sattvic choices, is going to give you the result of sattvic happiness. Whereas acting out of rajasic ambition and passion with a desire for personal gain is always going to be the source of suffering. I want to give you a kind of daily example of this from something that I know a lot about, which is how you handle that situation, which some people say is more scary than facing death, which is to say having to give a public talk in front of a large audience. As some of you may have experienced, public performance for some of us is really stressful and scary. And when you undertake a public event, whether you're giving a talk, as I do, or acting or playing music or running a meeting, you know, there are many, many ways in which you feel put on the spot by this. If you're doing it with a rajasic perspective, in other words, wanting to succeed, it's going to be stressful and you're going to feel horrible if you don't do it perfectly, and you're going to get very happy with yourself in a kind of a anxious way if you do well at it. And what we start to experience when we recognize this is that even when things turn out really well, if we've done it from that point of view, from that desire place, the experience of even success is not going to make us happy. The thing I learned just kind of in the course of my life is that the way to counteract this stress or is to consider that you're doing it, the act, as an act of service. That is, that you're preparing this, you're giving this teaching, or you're appearing in this role, or you're playing this song, or you're singing this tune, not to aggrandize your own greatness, but to give others an experience of something good, and ultimately as an offering to God. It will immediately put you into a sattvic state, which is one reason why Krishna continually tells us to do this. So Krishna says, from sattva comes wisdom, from rajas comes greed and craving, from tamas comes delusion and negligence. Tamas is the dust bunnies under the bed and dust bunnies in your brain state. Each quality gives rise to its own world of thoughts and emotions. So we're going to do a mindfulness meditation to just kind of feel into the way the gunas play in us. So you can close your eyes. Feel yourself inhaling down into the lower dantian, exhaling this time up into the heart. Imagine that your heart is a golden table, a kind of altar, feel as though you actually can imagine yourself going into your own heart. And creating this altar there. I've described it as golden. You might want to make it a beautiful pink velvet color. Or beautifully carved redwood, or carve it out of a sapphire. You know, it's your heart and your altar. You can make it as beautiful as you like. And once you've created this sense of altar in your heart, remember that this altar is made of light. So whatever form the light takes, whatever form this heart altar takes, its nature is light. On the altar, place a memory of happiness. And of course you do this by remembering a time when you felt pure happiness. Remembering where you were, what you were doing, taking yourself back to that memory. Imagining now that this memory of happiness is a cup. The cup contains scintillating rays of sattvic happiness. Place it on the altar in your heart. And now create a memory of being very, very consumed with Rajas Guna, and make it a relatively positive one, sometime when you were, you know, completely energized and doing 20 errands, multitasking, really in activity. And as you bring forth that memory, see if you can notice the feelings in your body that go with intense activity. There's energy in them, perhaps, probably. There's a sense of alertness, and there's also anxiety, stress, adrenaline. So pour the feelings of that memory into the cup, the Rajas Guna cup, and place it on the altar in the heart. And now, with great courage, feel your way into one of your really tamasic states. How does it feel when you're completely bored? And there's nothing you really want to do. And maybe someone you love said something mean to you, and it's triggered all your feelings of unworthiness and pointlessness. And your life feels gray and painful, and nothing feels important, and you just don't see any reason to do any practices. So feel into the felt sense of tama guna. And pour that feeling into the third cup. And place that on your altar. And notice how you can take a sip from the sattva guna cup and feel that happiness flowing through you. So let yourself do it. Take a sip from the Raja guna cup. And feel the power and energy and striving and stress of activity. And take a sip of the tamaguna cup. And let yourself for just a moment drink in your own experience of dark states. Now flow back to the sattvic cup. Take a sip of it. Then to the rajasic cup. Take a sip of it. Into the tamasic cup. And now become aware of that subtle substance, which is the heart altar, and then of the awareness that holds all this. That awareness that is the witness consciousness. Is present to all of these fluctuations. So at any moment, even in the midst of the most tamasic state, you can go back to that. So letting yourself be awareness, feeling the heart altar having risen and being held in awareness. Feel these, the presence of these three cups with their intrinsic states. And feel how when you are in awareness, you actually can choose to take a sip from the cup of sattva when you're in a tamasic state. Take a sip from the cup of rajas when you need to do something. And just have a moment of recognizing that all of this actually is a dance. That you are not these moods, that you are that which holds them. Just say thank you to yourself for the incredible creativity of your consciousness. Now, let me just say one more thing, one more general thing about the gunas. Krishna never says that it's possible to live in a human body without having some mixture of gunas. In fact, one of the teachings in this chapter is that we wouldn't be in a human body at all if we didn't have some rajas and tamas in us. And this is where it gets kind of interesting, or actually it's all pretty interesting, but this is the place where there's a lot of discussion and back and forth argument. In verse 18, Krishna points to our continuing transmigratory journey as the effect of the gunas. And he says that people who are mostly sattvic, in other words, who have consistently made the choice to turn to sipping the cup of sattva, such that their consciousness has been permeated with sattvic feelings, those people, those humans, rise to higher realms, which in the Indian tradition would be the realms of gods or the realms of sages, the subtle places where beings in bodies of light enjoy subtle states of pleasure, or realms where everyone is in deep meditation on the truth. The sattvic realms of existence, which are non-physical, they're very much about higher, subtler realms. On the other hand, people who act in seriously tamasic, deluded ways, who are violent, who are harmful, who are cruel, go to dark worlds, even into inert states where consciousness is very much dimmed, as in Iraq. And human beings are in the middle. Leaving aside the issue of whether or not you believe in reincarnation, let's think of these as states that we can experience in our bodies. But this is one of the things that he says very strongly. The human world is rajasic fundamentally. In other words, we are born, he says, as human beings because our consciousness is basically active. Souls whose nature draws us into human bodies enjoy activity, change, sensuality, power, expressing our individuality in creative ways, figuring out who we really are. All that stuff is intrinsic to human life. Human life, the human body, famously, is also the place where we can make choices, where we can do sadhana. So one of the desires that draws us into human bodies is the desire for ultimate freedom. But Aurobindo, in his commentary on this verse, says something that I find really, really beautiful. He says that Prakriti doesn't do anything except for pleasure. In other words, whatever manifests through Prakriti's creativity is all for the sake of her own bliss and enjoyment, and also to entertain her beloved Purusha, the witness. So what is true for Prakriti is true for us, because remember, we are Prakriti, and Prakriti's pleasure is simply a slightly denser form of the great blissfulness, the ananda, which is the nature of Krishna. So as Prakriti, we're made of the three gunas. It's our enjoyment of the play that keeps us in duality, because we wouldn't be human beings if we didn't like duality. And I found that really, really striking to contemplate, because if you think about how much of our poetry celebrates longing and suffering and grief, and think of how many times you've said or heard, "Only one who knows sorrow can appreciate joy." That beautiful poem of kindness, it says we can't know the deepest kindness until we know the deepest sorrow. And it's true in human life. Human beings learn from turmoil. What it means to be a human being, it means that we're committed in a certain sense to living in the movement of the gunas and learning how to navigate them. And Aurobindo, like Krishna himself, has noticed, and he says this often, that human beings are, when we are called to rise above duality into the pure light and joy of the higher realms, which happens to many of us periodically in our life, and as our practice deepens more and more, there is a part of us that can only handle it for a short time, or even in the early stages of recognizing the light, draws back from it, because the air of the higher realms is too refined for a human consciousness to live in for very long. So we keep living out situations that let us experience the back and forth of we move from happiness to suffering to dullness, desire and anger, impulsive mistakes, the heights of human love and the depths of tragedy. It's all part of the way we experience the world, because as human beings we have a natural predominance of Rajas Guna. The human body, in fact, is the crystallization of the soul's Rajasic tendencies, and it's also a very important stage in consciousness, because it's through Rajas that we kind of rise out of our embeddedness in the material and become able to open ourselves more and more deeply to Sattva Guna. So when you're feeling, "Oh my God, why is it that last week my heart was singing and I was in love with everything and this week I'm in total gloom, what's wrong with me?" All that means is that you're having the experience of more and more deeply understanding the way the gunas move. And it's also why Krishna says that the real solution is always to rise above the gunas, to become Trigunatita, which means the one who is beyond the gunas, to be the knower of the field. Or, and this is what he says in the very last verse of this chapter, to completely give yourself to devotion. So when Arjuna asks Krishna, how do you know that someone has gone beyond the gunas? He answers in one of the most famous verses in the whole Gita. And I'm going to paraphrase it. I'm going to give it to you in Aurobindo's translation, because Aurobindo really puts it, it's not a literal translation, but it expresses the meaning. And since Aurobindo is himself an illumined sage, I think we can pretty well accept his teaching on this topic. So here's what he says. One who does not shrink from the illuminated joy of rising sattva, who doesn't resist the impulse to act that arises when rajas is in operation, and who can bear the clouding over of the mind and nervous system when tamas is in charge, that person has risen above the gunas. In other words, Krishna says, quote, he seats himself in the witness like a person watching the play of the gunas from above, and he's able to recognize that the gunas are moving on their own, seeing that the gunas are playing on their own while he remains apart. And he then goes on to one of the most famous verses in spiritual literature, a verse that is both completely inspiring and totally discouraging, because it feels kind of hard to attain. He says, so beautiful, he says, one who regards happiness and suffering alike, who sees gold and mud and stone as of equal status, to whom the pleasant and unpleasant, praise and blame, honor and insult, friends and enemies are equal, who is steadfast in wisdom and calm, who initiates no action but leaves it to be done by Prakriti, that one is said to be beyond the gunas. So the question, is it actually possible to experience happiness and suffering, honor and insult, friends and enemies as the same? My answer to this question has always been, I'm working on it, and there are times when it's true. But what I've come to realize, as I'm sure many of you have also, that this verse is not, it's not just a description of an enlightened state, essentially. It's an instruction of how to touch that place where we can flow with our life. This is actually a teaching about acceptance, which is, of course, one of the very core contemporary teachings, is that the way to deal with the pain of life, as well as the joy of life, as well as its confusion, is to practice an attitude of acceptance. It's just to go, okay, I can handle the very high exalted states that come to me sometimes without trying to bring myself down. I can deal with the stress of having to throw myself into an activity, and I can even accept the bad parts. I am even willing to accept tamas, as in this exquisite poem of William Butler Yeats called The Dialogue of Self and Soul. He says, I am willing to accept the lot, to forgive myself the lot. I'm willing to live this with full presence and commitment. So this is the way that an active person can become Trigunatita, through this attitude of acceptance, not resignation, and you know this very well, not resignation, but actually the recognition that whatever is arising is an aspect of the great force of consciousness, Krishna himself. So I just want to take a minute to feel our way into acceptance. I am accepted, because the ego can't really accept our life. It's Shakti, it's consciousness, it's Krishna, it's the great soul that has already accepted our life. See if you can feel your way into that deep acceptance that recognizes that you are Saddharmya, you are permeated by your alignment with your own truth, with the self, with that great love that permeates the Bhagavad Gita and every particle of this world. Just let yourself feel that. And if you're not feeling it, recognize that that too is accepted. And with that attitude, that recognition of how totally we are already accepted, we are already loved and held, with that attitude, we then continue in our practice of training ourselves in sattva guna. It's such an interesting paradox to know it's all okay because it's all part of the one. And it's really good if I can make my consciousness pure and heartfelt. So at the end of chapter 16, which is a fabulous fire and brimstone sermon about the difference between pure states and dark states, which is called the Yoga of the Distinction Between the Divine and the Demoniacal, Krishna says to Arjuna, so the way you make sure that you're accessing sattva is to keep practicing the injunctions of the scriptures. In other words, to do what the sages tell us to do. And by scriptures, he really does mean the enlightened scriptures, the scriptures of the non-dual, the scriptures like the Gita, which really intend us to recognize that since everything is made of God, our behavior should naturally be kind and compassionate and vigorous and fearless and generous and be filled with all those qualities that we call virtues. We need to know, in other words, essentially how to get into a sattvic state when we slip out of it, and we need to be committed to that. So Krishna tells Arjuna, rather than following your own desires, follow the instructions of the sages and act in accordance with what they tell us, which sounds like a boilerplate religious injunction. It sounds as if Krishna is telling Arjuna to be a good boy, follow the rules. However, he follows that statement by saying, and by the way, if you just love me, or if you just love those people who love me, then that in of itself, love and do as you will, in St. Augustine's words, will actually protect you. And as always, you know, that's Krishna's get-out-of-jail-free card. Love God. Love me. Be devoted. Make offerings. And it's okay. You don't have to follow the rules all the time. And in Arjuna's first question in chapter 17 is about this. He says, look, suppose you can't follow the rules, and he's talking about himself, of course, because Arjuna is a pretty post-conventional guy. Plus, he's a warrior, you know, so he's a man of action. He often acts according to demands that may not be scripturally halakhic, as Orthodox Judaism has it. And here is where Aurobindo has something super important to tell us about what Krishna is getting at. The name of chapter 17, which is kind of the chapter of about how to apply the gunas, it's called the Yoga of the Divisions of Faith. And it's about how the gunas work with our convictions, with our religious practices, with our meditation, etc. Aurobindo, who was himself a powerfully inner-directed practitioner and a very modern practitioner, really a pathfinder in what I think is perhaps the great modern understanding of spirituality, which is that our spiritual practice is an expression of the evolution of consciousness, not only our personal consciousness, but also of the great consciousness. You know, it's the idea that we are impelled by the evolutionary impulse that wants to carry human beings towards recognition of the One. He says that at a certain point, It's utterly necessary to leave the rules behind and follow your inner guidance, because the scriptures are rules for the masses. They're the general instructions. And as you walk your path, as you follow your journey, and every one of you knows this, there are going to be moments when you have to figure out, or figure out's the wrong word, when your demands that come to you are asking you to follow guidance that doesn't come from outside, that comes from within you. And he also says that there are moments when not only adventurous seekers, but also entire societies turn away from the orthodox religious descriptions of reality, not because they want to be, you know, desire-ridden, rajasic bad boys and bad girls, but because their consciousness has evolved, their wisdom has evolved, and they need a way to live and practice that's appropriate to their level of consciousness. In other words, that as consciousness evolves, spirituality also evolves, which means specifically that modern rational consciousness can't follow blindly the idea of a punishing, jealous God, for instance, or accept the virgin birth if you're a Christian, or believe that when Jesus says, I am the way, he means that he is the only way, or look at menstrual blood as impure, or have a cemented in place caste system in which people can't improve their lives or improve their experience. So we begin to look as individuals and as a collective for guidance that matches our intuitive sense of what's right, what allows progress in our particular time. And in this stage, we're not possessed by egoic desires. And that means that we can only follow our instincts, because instinct may be fine for navigating, our animal self, our eating and our sexuality and our reproduction. But it's not necessarily the path to the higher and often unknown aspects of the journey. So there's a certain point when each one of us has to take a step into the unknown. We have to walk through the gateless gate, as the Buddhists say, into that place beyond everything that we took for granted. And in this place, your desires should have been clarified so that you actually can start to see the difference between an impulse that comes from egoic desire and an impulse that is guidance from the inner guru. And this is the stage I mentioned earlier that St. Augustine was referring to when he counseled somebody to love God and do as you will, on the premise that if your love is really pure, you are incapable of doing anything that is not in service of love. But Aurobindo also points out, and this is Arjuna's question, that what are the criteria that we can use from moving in the subtle field of inner guidance? In other words, if we're going to start letting go of the rules and stop following orthodox procedures, what do we rely on? And what Krishna, this is Arjuna's question, how do you know you're doing it? How do you know what to do when you're not a scholar of scriptures and you've also, progressed beyond feeling that everything you do has to be according to the way you were told to do things. In other words, when you're learning how to act with spontaneous wisdom, how do you know you're on the right track? And the whole chapter is based on this understanding that it's the nature of our inner conviction, our shraddha. Shraddha is a Sanskrit word that's usually translated as faith, but it doesn't mean kind of standard or garden variety religious type faith. It actually means conviction. It's the conviction that lets you put your heart fully into something because you know that it's important. It's the conviction of priorities. It's the sense of that it really is true that this world is made of God, is made of love, and that the most important thing you can do is trust that and do everything you can to act in a way that expresses the sadharma, your alignment with the divine. So our Shraddha, our faith, determines what we show up for and the fullness within which we show up. So it's a really good question to ask yourself in any moment, okay, where is my faith now? Where am I putting my trust? Is it in my own strength? Is it in my family money? Is it in my good health? Is it in my conviction of what's fair and just? Is it in, you know, that spiritual teacher that you just met who said that you'll experience full awakening if you take their retreat? Do you put your trust in God? If so, in what aspect of God, in what face of God? So this is where Krishna really applies his teaching of the gunas. And in the third verse of chapter 17, he says something that is really pretty significant. He says, our Shraddha, our conviction, our faith, conforms to our basic nature. Human nature is made of our conviction. What we have faith in determines who we are, and a person is what his conviction is. What we have faith in determines who we are, and a person is what his conviction is. I'm going to ask you to contemplate this question this week. It's a huge question. So what does he mean? Well, basically, he's saying that we become what we believe ourselves to be, which is, you know, by doing the actions that are natural to who we think we are. And, you know, in very mundane terms, that means if your conviction is that you're, say, not smart enough to go to college, it's going to be very hard for you to do the actions that are going to allow you to apply to college and get into college. And even if you do, you're going to find yourself kind of shying away from fully engaging in that intellectual process. And this is, of course, triply true when it comes to spiritual practice. To some extent, what he's saying here is that our nature is determined by the karmic imprints of our previous actions. So in other words, if we have consistently worked with our conviction such that we, you know, we deliberately hold the feeling of being good people, of being smart enough, of being capable, and of being connected, you know, that the conviction that takes us towards growth, of course, becomes subtler and subtler the more we practice. So that after a while, and I know this is true for many of you, the conviction that the goal of our life is truth and that the engine of our existence is divine love, that conviction becomes really the platform on which we live our life. And this means that at that point, in those moments when we really are in that conviction, we have a swabhava, an inner soul quality. Swabhava means actually your true nature, the nature of your soul that is fundamentally sattvic. And the same is true of the other gunas. You know, we may have a lot of rajasic or tamasic qualities in our nature which show up as, you know, fundamentally obstructions to deep practice. But as we keep turning towards sattvic convictions and sattvic actions, our capacity for sattva guna strengthens. And one of the things that we've learned in our time, which doesn't seem to have been available in Krishna and Arjuna's period of history, we know that people can change. We know that societies can change. And we, you know, we know that it is possible for human society to become more equal-minded, more inclusive, more willing to make opportunities available for people to transform their lives. That, you know, consciousness evolves, societies evolve, and that means our understanding about the world and our experience of ourselves is not a done deal. That is, the more we recognize that we are evolving and that our own temperament is a work in progress, the more we realize that we actually have way more choice than people did in Arjuna's time. And that not just because, you know, you can take a pill and shift your mood, because now we know about neuroplasticity. We realize how much power our practices and our actions for social justice and our ability to, you know, inquire into the true meaning of our life, how much we can change the gunas that predominate in our nature. And I know you've all seen this. You've all seen how your unexamined assumptions change as you evolve, and how your depression and cynicism and carelessness begins more and more to dissolve through the power of your practice and neuroplasticity. So when we look at how we do what we do, at our motives, at the way we do our actions, we see how the gunas are playing in us. And so Krishna gives Arjuna some guidance about how the gunas play in the type of conviction we have, in the type of offerings we make, in the way we treat ourselves and other people, in what we eat. And these very famous verses about the way the gunas play in our life are tremendously important as touchstones for us to look at in our self-inquiry. So when Krishna tells Arjuna, and I think it's in verse 4 in this chapter, he talks about the way in which a sattvic person makes offerings. A sattvic person, he says, makes offerings to the light beings, to the gods, and of course to Krishna himself. A rajasic person does his practice for the sake of getting empowered by those forces in the universe that can help the rajasic person become stronger, richer, better looking, and more successful. And a tamasic person essentially feels close to the psychic forces that exist in the cosmos and that can make a person with a kind of endarkened or painful nature feel supported. And I'm not going to talk very much about the tamasic goals. But I do want to talk a little bit about what it means in terms of practice to be making offerings to the gods, as it were, or offerings to the beings who exist at a lesser level of consciousness but who can be helpful to our human projects. So if you're doing your practice for the sake of coming close to the truth of your nature, in other words, for the sake of light, of growth, you'll be guided by that desire. And that means you'll look for teachers, for instance, who epitomize commitment to truth. You'll sit for meditation as best as you can without expecting flashy experiences, but you won't neglect meditation even if you're not having fabulous experiences. You'll be rigorous in the way you do the practice. You'll always start your practice with mantras. According to Krishna, this is utterly significant because it's the mantras that will give us, mantras are kind of our lifeline to divine guidance. We use the altar because sattvic people who do spiritual practices normally have altars, and we use the altar as a way of focusing our attention on the consciousness at the heart of everything. So our spiritual activities are all about making things more sacred, and we treat everything that surrounds our practice with respect. And even if we don't know the protocols of traditional ritual, if we have a sacred attitude, we will know how to treat ourselves in the presence of our practice. And, you know, so for example, as a sattvic person, if you set up a statue of Krishna or the goddess, you don't put it on the floor. You put it in an elevated place, which is the way you're supposed to treat an altar. But there's a kind of natural feeling of how to create sacred space. You know, you bathe, you keep your altar clean, you create an intention when you sit that reminds you that your goal is truth, that your goal is clarity, that your goal is love. So your conviction, your commitment is going to make it so much easier for you to do sattvic practice. Now, of course, we're living in a time and in a society in which rajaguna predominates, and of course we bring rajas qualities into our practice. And that, you know, if we were doing a satire of the contemporary spiritual and yoga scene in the United States today, you probably would discover that the entire field is permeated with rajas guna. So, for instance, a rajasic practice is done with expectation that every meditation session is going to give you an experience or else you've failed. Or you might compete with your friends about who has the best spiritual art. Your yoga clothes are top of the line, and you go to see charismatic teachers, especially famous ones. So you're there for Amma's Devi Bawa, and you go on yoga vacations, and when a new guru comes to town, you make sure to check him out or check her out. You've been known to injure yourself in yoga class because you just can't resist doing advanced arm balances, even though you know you don't have the strength, because it's so important to you to look good. You do Lakshmi Puja when you're looking for a job or when you need money, but if it doesn't seem like the puja gives immediate fruits, then you install a statue of, say, Lalita and begin to chant the Lalita Sahasranam. And you do ayahuasca ceremonies with visiting Peruvian shamans, and you think about becoming a shaman yourself, and your decor is full of Zen touches, and you read all the hot spiritual books. You know how it is. You're define yourself as a spiritual seeker, and your conviction about yourself is that you're a spiritual seeker. And honestly, I don't think there's one of us here in contemporary society, and not only in the Western world, but all over the world, who does spiritual practice, who does not to some extent identify ourselves as spiritual seekers. In other words, all of us are to some extent rajasic practitioners. And that's just a very interesting thing to look at and to see how you can go beyond that, because rajas guna is going to show up right in the middle of your most exalted meditation process and tell yourself, oh my God, I'm really a good meditator, and maybe it's time I wrote my spiritual autobiography. No, it's a joke, but it's a joke based on human nature. And by the way, a tamasic practitioner, I would say, is first of all very careless and lackadaisical about doing practice. And one of the characteristics of tamasic practice is that very often it involves intoxicating substances. When you're in a tamasic state, you have a lot of resistance to practice. And your altar is often full of dead flowers, and you put your wallet and keys on it as if it were a side table. You get your instructions from random YouTube videos, and you're very, very critical and negative about spiritual teachers. You're always looking for the flaws in spiritual communities, and very often scoring sexually at retreat. In other words, to some extent, when you go to a yoga retreat, this is rajasic also. It's a part of you that's looking around. So this is the natural course of life in the three gunas. It's not our fault, and it's something that we need to move through. One of the really interesting pieces here is what Krishna says about sattvic tapas, and this is what we're going to make our focus for the week to come. The Sanskrit word tapas means burning or heat, and again, as most of you know, it refers to the friction created in the body and mind when we practice spiritual discipline. Richard Freeman has a great way of talking about tapas. He says it's like when you do tapas, you squeeze yourself so that, you squeeze yourself, you squeeze your body, you squeeze your mind, through intent, one-pointed focus. So, and it kind of squeezes out distraction and impurity so that you can begin to find the midline, as it were, the clear sushumna nadi, the sattvic state, comes about through tapas. So a person who does sattvic tapas practices, Krishna says in chapter 17, practices harmlessness constantly. And as several of you shared so beautifully about your harmlessness practice this week, it's like when you're practicing harmlessness, you treat everyone with respect. You're ethical with all of your involvements with people, whether they're social or sexual. You're with the way you use your energy. You're ethical about money. You go out of your way to offer service in ways that might be very active. And these are these kind of practices are what are called austerities or tapas of the body. So they're the practices of reverence, really. They're practices of reverence and respect and service. Krishna talks about the tapas of speech. He says, the words of someone who does sattvic tapas are sweet and kind. Such a person doesn't speak sarcastically or harshly. And if that person has nothing to contribute to the conversation, he stays quiet. He's willing to offer wisdom when he's asked, but he doesn't need to set himself up as an expert. So everything he says is for the purpose of creating harmony. And the way he keeps his mind is filled with a connection, with the intention to rest the mind in the self. So a person who does sattvic tapas pays close attention to wandering thoughts. There's an image in Yaneshwari in which he says such a person treats his mind like a wayward daughter and keeps her closely supervised. So, and it's, you know, kind of a sexist image. But in a certain sense, if you're the parent of a wild teenager, you know, and you're a conscientious parent, you're going to make sure that the kid has some structure and discipline. And tapas, mental tapas, is all about not allowing thoughts to wander, or when they do, remembering that the thoughts are consciousness. Constantly bringing the mind back to mantra, back to the teachings, back to self-inquiry, learning to rest in the witness, practicing imaginative, devotional bhavas or contemplation practices, and meditating. And you know you're doing rajasic tapas. Krishna's very good about, smart about this, when you're secretly hoping that people will notice what a great practitioner you are. So rajasic tapas is pretty much done for respect and admiration. Tamasic tapas is physically painful, and this is one of Krishna's main teachings in this chapter. He says, tamasic practitioners believe that purification means punishing the body. So excessive fasting, doing things like, you know, intense sweat lodges, the kind of monastic austerities that people still do in some parts of the Christian world, where you flagellate yourself or you wear very uncomfortable clothes because you think that punishing your body is going to help free you from sins. These are tamasic austerities. And Krishna says very poignantly that this kind of tapas actually hurts God's own body. And, of course, it does no good. I mean, in the same way, he points out that sattvic practice, in every way, whether it's giving, whether it's meditation, whether it's yoga, whether it's service, is always done without expectation of getting something back, just because it's your conviction that this is the right thing to do. So this week, what I'd love to ask you to do as a walking around practice and as a contemplation practice is take these verses on sattvic tapas, which really means, because the way Krishna uses tapas, he really means spiritual practice. Because these verses really tell you how to live your life as a form of sattvic practice, moment-to-moment sattvic practice. So you'll look at the verses, you'll read the verses, and you'll take on these practices in the best way you can, and I think you'll have a lot of grace for taking them on. Just committing yourself with shraddha, with conviction, with the willingness to show up, to experimenting with sattvic practice. And you'll notice as you do that there are all these rajasic and tamasic tendencies that show up, because that's how it is. And when that happens, you create a field of acceptance and you return to, at the next moment, to walking and moving and speaking with reverence, to disciplining your mind, and to noticing what the effect is when it's hard, when it flows, and who you are when you're really committing yourself, even for an hour, to living as a sattvic tapasvin, a sattvic practitioner. So let's close our eyes, and we'll return to our original meditation, And if you can sit for a while at the end of the class, that would be great. So you're firmly present here in this moment. You're seated with connection to the seat. Your breath is flowing in through the crown with the sense that every breath brings in Krishna's light and love and grace. Inhaling, allowing Krishna's light, Krishna's dark blue, bliss-saturated, completely empowered grace to flow into your body through the crown, to fill your body down to your toes. And then as you exhale, you breathe out openness, spaciousness, willingness to accept the gift of grace that is being breathed into you by that one whose love is the source of this exquisite teaching. With every breath, you draw in Krishna's light, perhaps also with the mantra, Om Namo Narayanaya. With every exhalation, you open yourself to receive. Have a beautiful evening, a beautiful week. So much love. Namaste.